Welcome to the Rogue Startups Podcast, where two startup founders are sharing lessons learned and pitfalls to avoid in their online businesses. And now, here's Dave and Craig.
Welcome to episode 107 of Rogue Startups. Craig, how the hell are you doing today?
Man, I'm doing great. I'm back from Dublin, which is always it's always like a bittersweet thing to go to Ireland and then come back because it's a beautiful place. But every time I go, Dublin especially gets the best of me, and it definitely happened again at like the last night party of SaaStoc this year was great, and actually learned a lot and met some really great people. But also was out till like 4 o'clock in the morning. So yeah, the flight back was a long flight.
I bet it was.
Yeah.
Bet you'd be wishing you had your lucky charms then.
Right. Exactly. But have you been to Ireland?
I've never been to Ireland. It's definitely on the list of places that my wife and I both want to go. She's never gone either. Okay. And we also want to go to Scotland. Both of those very, you know, I have ancestors that are from Scotland. My wife has always wanted to see Ireland. So both of those are, you know, very high on our travel list. We've both been to the England and traveled around in the UK and various places, but never those particular places. So definitely high on the list.
Gotcha. This summer we went to both, and then we went to Ireland last year as well. I would say our experiences, they're very different. Ireland for us was more kind of outdoorsy and like nature centric. We spent a lot of time in the city in Scotland this year. So maybe we didn't have the best kind of sampling of it, but yeah, they're both.
Were you in Glasgow?
We were in Edinburgh. Yeah.
Edinburgh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Beautiful, wonderful city. And they have this huge, like, month-long music festival every August, which we coincidentally were there for. But it's very cool, just like a bunch of street music every day and night. So, yeah, if you're there in August, be prepared to pay more for, I forget what they call their big music festival, but it's like all month of August.
Livestock?
Right.
Apologies to all the Scottish people in the audience. I just offended them.
No, so when I come for – if I come for MicroConf next year, I'll wear my kilt that I bought. It's pretty rocking, yeah.
Oh, nice. We should come together with kilts.
Oh, we've just lost our 27 listeners.
Yeah, they're all like, dude, the one thing we don't want to see is either of you in a kilt, let alone the two of you together.
Yeah, you don't know. Don't knock until you try it.
Yeah, well –
So how's business?
You know, things are good with Recapture. We just pushed a major release out the door last Monday, and we've been kind of mopping up with it since. And I mean mopping up in the sense of not, you know, the bodies that happen from the shrapnel of the explosion crater, but more along the lines of just little details. So we pushed everything out into production, and it was mostly a test of stability. And now we're trying to get some people upgraded. We can push them into beta status for the new feature of Review Booster. But in order to get there, we have to go through a bunch of packaging horse shit with the Magento extension. And then there was some stuff that we didn't really know how to do the Magento 1. I thought we did. We didn't. And then the Magento 2, we had to create a new upgrade script for that. And then we had to figure out some way to do this manually because it's going to take 6 freaking weeks for this stuff to show up in the Magento marketplace.
Hmm.
You know, having worked with WordPress where you just literally click a button, poof, your new version is out there in the repository right then and there. You know, there's an approval period to get you into the repository. But once you're there, you can push updates pretty liberally. And I appreciate that. Like, it's all on you. If you screw it up, okay, you got to push something to fix it or people are just going to uninstall your shit.
Yeah.
Well, you know, with Magento, and I understand that there is a level of paranoia that goes with this because there is significantly more money in the Magento ecosystem. So, you know, you don't want to push something that's breaking people's stores. On the other hand, taking 6 freaking weeks to get something approved in the Magento marketplace – is too damn long. Like, I can't release my stuff fast enough. Let's say I have a bug patch and, you know, I release something, it gets all the way through QA, and then a week after it gets out in the wild, I find that there's a bug and I need to fix it in the extension. It's going to take me another 6 weeks. I have to deal with 6 weeks of support thanks to these guys.
Even for an update?
Even for updates. It doesn't matter whether you're pushing a major version, a minor version, or even a tiny little patch.
That's
they
crazy.
All take the same amount of time. It is insane.
That's
absolutely
crazy.
Insane.
Yeah.
So we're starting on that process now, but now we also had to deal with the how can I do this manually, because people want to do it now, and I'm not going to tell them you have to wait 6 weeks. That's crap. So we've had to put all that stuff together. It wasn't stuff I had really thought about until we pushed it out into the store, and then all of a sudden I'm like, all right, let's start somebody up, and then I'm like, wait a minute, they need the new extension. Shit, how are we going to get the new extension to them?
Mm-hmm.
So chalk it up to me not really thinking that one ahead.
Have you seen what Pippin is doing with like he has like a beta repository for his plugins now?
I have seen that, and I'm on his email list, so I get a fair number of announcements, you know, saying, hey, Affiliate WP is in beta. Hey, software licensing is in beta. Hey, this is in beta. I never, you know, even his release stuff is a little shaky sometimes. I wait for the .1 release of pretty much anything he shoves out the door because mm-hmm. my store depends on it. So I can't have flaky shit going on there. And so I largely ignore all the beta stuff, and I largely ignore all the initial releases. And when I see the first bug patch release, I'm like, okay, time to upgrade.
Yeah, yeah. I just think it's a savvy way of having your stuff available if you want to sort of opt in to get the latest kind of cutting-edge release, non-stable release, then that's available to them. And you can easily just sort of point it to them. Yeah, in the past, we've like sent plug-in updates and patches to people via Dropbox and stuff, and I feel like that's just ghetto. So yeah, we're looking at doing some of that Git based stuff.
I am all about ghetto software myself. It's duct tape and alien wire all the way down.
Yeah, that's
I'm kidding. My stuff is much better than that.
Yeah.
I'm far more anal than that statement lets on. And but it's still funny. Yeah, the Git stuff, having the repo out there, I mean, we've actually got a Bitbucket repository where we have the connector and we push, you know, we tag releases that are out there. So we can point people at that stuff and say, if you want this release, here's the master branch, here's the last stable branch. And, you know, the problem in the Magento ecosystem is, you know, it really is in two different camps. There are the Magento developers who understand the tech stuff really deeply. They're pretty full stack guys. And then there are the store owners that, you know, they can't even spell Bitbucket.
Mm-hmm.
They have no idea what the hell that even is and sure. why. You know, they can barely use the Magento extension panel for the most part, and they rely very heavily on their developers. And rightly so, because if you're a store owner, you really shouldn't have to be worrying about all those technical things once your store is up and running. You want to have a tech staff that's good at handling that, and you handle all the other stuff. So when we've got stuff like this, I only really have contact with the store owners. And so a lot of times they're like, oh, you need to go talk to so-and-so of our developers, or I'll pass that along and I'll let you know. So, you know, there's definitely some waiting. So I've got several people lined up to try this. One is for sure working on it right now. The other two I just haven't heard back from. And we just got a bunch of stuff packaged up today. So later on, I've got to shove it out into the Magento marketplace and migrate stuff, and then yeah, just a bunch of hassle there. But yeah, things are going well otherwise. We had some very minor glitches last week doing the release and worked them all out on the day of the release, and I'm pretty happy with where things ended up. So
that's awesome. All good. That's awesome. And that's your first big release, right? That's a great sign if you can have your first major release without any huge sort of headaches or bumps, right?
Yeah, and this was a big one. Like, we pushed a lot of stuff out there. You know, there was a significant number of changes under the covers. Not all of them were visible in the user interface. There's some definite improvements that people were looking for. But, you know, the fact that we didn't totally destabilize everything means I hired a good developer. His QA methods were good. You know, I went through – I didn't feel like – when I was going through the process that there was a lot of scary, shaky stuff going on the test server. And he's the one who was like, all right, before we start, here's what I really need to be successful as a developer. He's like, I got to have this QA environment. I've got to have these test servers. Like, we set up a test Magento 1 store, test Magento 2 store, the full server. He's got Jenkins in there. I mean, none of this stuff existed from the previous guy. So like, I burned probably about a third of my dev budget on this release, just getting all this test shit set up. And I don't regret any of it now. At the time, I was kind of like, well, I guess we'll see. I know why you want this. I know the developer side of me is like, yep, but the business side of me was like, I'm not really going to recoup a lot out of this.
Where's the duct tape?
Yeah, duct tape and baling wire, man. But yeah, now I'm totally on board with it. So yeah, he obviously did a great job and we're pushing forward. He's fixed a bunch of other minor issues after the release that we decided we wanted to update and add in there. Mostly just around, not activating our tracking codes and stuff in the QA server because it's totally contaminating our statistics right now. Minor stuff. So that's good. It's wins all around for Recapture right now. That's for sure.
Awesome. That's great to hear, man. Nice.
How about yourself? What you just got back from SaaStalk, so you must be totally jazzed about what's going on there. How are the businesses?
Good. Yeah, I mean, it was interesting to be at a conference, and that's kind of what we're going to be talking about today is kind of my takeaways and kind of us chatting through some of the things that I observed or saw at SaaStalk last week, because it was definitely a different type of conference than we probably typically go to. But generally, business is good. Podcast Motor is kind of similarly on, I'll say, autopilot. We're chugging along, kind of status quo there, which is great because focusing a lot on Seriously Simple Podcasting and growing our hosting platform there. And it's growing, for being at this point 4.5 months into it, it's surprisingly steady at this point. Like, we're growing about the same absolute amount every month, which is great. A certain number of users and dollars, and our numbers kind of that we talked about a couple of weeks ago, our trial to paid conversion is about the same, and our new customers and MRR added each month are about the same. So that's great. We're working on a ton of new stuff right now. We're spending a bunch of money, which is a little stressful, but, we're really making some huge improvements to the platform. I'll say in the next month, we'll roll out basically a whole new product, which is awesome, but expensive and scary, and doing a lot of thinking about how to do that strategically. And you get kind of one chance to do some of these releases. Just doing a lot of thinking and talking to people that I know and trust about how they've done some of these things in the past, because some of them, kind of like your release that you were talking about, like some of these big release things and updates are really kind of like one-time things where we can make a great impression or we can fuck it up and shoot ourselves in the foot. So yeah, it's a relatively stressful time, but I think no matter what happens, we'll get through it. And afterwards, we'll have something that we really can throw a lot of marketing effort at. I feel like a little bit right now we're kind of waiting on some of these things to come through. So we're probably not banging the marketing drum as hard as we can or should, but, we're starting to roll some of them out and testing a few things. So getting some initial data on things like Facebook ads and affiliates and content and things like that. And I'm starting to get a little bit of a feel for some of these things, but, I'll say by November, it's the end of September right now, by November, we'll be pretty ready to dive in headfirst with some of these things. So it's exciting, but at the same time, in the next, say, month or 6 weeks, there's a lot of stuff that's going to happen. So it's exciting and nerve-wracking at the same time.
Nice. So, nice.
Not to be too vague, but I'll talk about it more as it comes, I guess.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt.
But yeah, so last week at SaaStalk, I think a lot of people that listen to the show have been to MicroConf and know that it is the conference for bootstrap software companies, online businesses. SaaStalk is the European version of SASTER. So in attendance this year out of 1,500 people, I'll say a third were VC firms and partners at VC firms. Another third were venture-backed companies, maybe more than that, 45%. And then a small percentage, the vocal minority, were bootstrapped companies.
vocal, no doubt,
yeah. Yeah, yeah. I thought we'd kind of talk through some of the things that I really kind of observed, and then get your take on some of these topics. Because I knew going into it, I was talking to my wife, I was like, one, I'm a little nervous going to a place where there are people who want to give me money, because it's like a really weird sort of dynamic that I'd never been in before. And we're definitely not ready to take money. I don't know if we would ever take money, but it was just something I hadn't ever thought of until I was like, wow, I'm leaving tomorrow to a place where if the conversation goes right, somebody could be like, hey, you know, we'd love to take, you know, a 20% equity interest in your business for like $2 million or whatever the numbers would be. And I'm like, I have no effing idea how to approach that conversation or even think about it. So just going into it, I would say if anybody goes to one of these conferences, have like an honest kind of assessment of, in that respect, what your goal is, or your goal definitely isn't, and how to approach that. And so I knew kind of going into this, my goal was like, just talk to some of these VC folks. So I think there could be a time where we would take money in the future, but we're too young right now. So I just kind of wanted to be in information gathering mode going into this and make some connections. So in that respect, that was kind of like one of my goals, but it definitely kind of brought to mind like the when you would take money mental conversation that I was having with myself. Have you ever thought about taking money? I mean, like, I think Recapture probably is in a place where if you get it right, if you could inject whatever amount of money in the business, could it do like a ton better, right? Have you ever thought about that?
I have thought about it, and the answer is fucking hell no.
So, okay.
It is just – it's against my DNA at this point. Like, okay, that is never my goal. My goal is not to build it and throw it out into the world and make it like bigger than me. It is all about – supporting my lifestyle. Like, okay, that's it. That's my main goal. And I would be happy with it throwing off a significant 5-figure a month MRR.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
Not to say I would stop growing it at that point, but I would be unbelievably comfortable where I was at that point. And then I might reevaluate. But right now, like, that is literally the farthest thought from my mind is VC anything. I mean, my personal experience with VCs in the 3 or 4 startups I've been associated with has not been overwhelmingly positive. So, you know, it's not something I'm really interested in. It's not something I've had that left a good taste in my mouth in general. It's not something that I feel like would drive Recapture where I want it to go. I think they would want significant control, or, you know, have their own opinions, and suddenly I'm at a fight with somebody else about that, and then that takes the joy out of what I'm doing. It's not really me. So,
yeah,
you know, going to a conference where they were like, all right, it's going to be half VCs and half bootstrapped, I'd be like, okay, well, I guess I'm talking to half of the other people. I mean, it probably wouldn't be like that, but, you know, there's half of the people that I would really bond with, and the other half of the people I would feel on with.
Yeah,
is really what it would end up being.
And that was the dynamic. Was I had a couple of conversations with people from VC firms, just kind of like randomly, like in a group or sit next to them at lunch randomly. And we get talking, and they were all very nice. I mean, it's like, similar to you, I probably would never take venture funding. I would take it, I think, after thinking about this and talking to some people, I would take it if I knew that my exit opportunities were drastically better, whether that's money or connections or whatever. If we were, say, 2 years away from making a really big exit and someone being a part of my company could really help that in some way, I would definitely do it. We're not there yet, because I think we're – so I didn't realize this. To get, quote, product market fit is $1 million MRR by the definition at the conference last week. They had it broken into like 3 stages. And traction is product market fit is $1 million MRR. So we're definitely not there yet, but
No. Yeah. And that's like for those that are doing the numbers, that's roughly about 83,000 a month.
Yeah.
So that's gross. So if you're making anything less than $83,000 a month, VCs in general are not that interested in you.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And yeah, I think the categories are what, like, 1 million and below, 2 to 5 million, and then over 6, right?
It seemed like less than a million to 10,
and then more than 10 million.
Yeah. Oh, 1 to 10. Okay. All right. Yeah. Slightly different. Yeah. Similar bucketing, slightly different numbers. But
yeah.
I mean, you know, if I got recapture up to 50,000 a month, I mean, I'm going to have thrown off plenty of money from my family, myself, overhead, employees to help run the business. I get a big fat paycheck out of that. I don't care at that point whether I get to the magic 83,000 a month. You know, that's just not that important to me. And a lot of people in the bootstrap community feel very similarly. And some don't. Like, you know, obviously Rob was not necessarily thinking about, you know, Drip as an acquirable property up front. It became more attractive as he went on. And then suddenly, you know, Lead Pages came knocking on the door and he basically threw in a bunch of I've got to have it or I'm walking. And they're like, okay, you got all those. And he's like, oh, well,
yeah,
it's hard to say no. So,
you should never say absolutely no, because I think in every business, probably if you're there long enough and it's successful enough, there's a time where the answer should be yes.
I think that the possibility could exist, but for me right now, I just don't ever see it getting there.
Sure.
It's not my goal to grow it to a point to get it there to where somebody would be interested in me. Like, I have no motivation to do that for anybody else.
Yeah.
You know, this is all about me, my lifestyle, my family. This is my retirement plan. You know, I have no other retirement plan. This is it.
Yep. So interesting on the last point on VCs, the one kind of most in-depth conversation I had with someone who's just very nice and giving a bunch of advice was that they look at churn more than anything else. Like, they weight it more than anything else. So everyone who's building a SaaS type product out there, looking at churn and getting a good hold on churn from the very beginning, they said they'll look at your churn all the way back to like when you launch, which as someone who just launched, I know that it changes, you know, kind of drastically when you have 10 users, your churn is all over the place. But so I think it kind of relates to their metric for product market fit. You know, that's kind of the metric they use for like, is this something people get value out of? So for everyone out there, pay attention to your churn and think a lot about, is what you're providing valuable and are people wanting to stay around for a long time? Because lower churn is great for growing your business if you're going to bootstrap it. If you're going to raise funding, sounds like it's a really important thing to be able to show folks if you go that route.
Yep, that totally makes sense. And, you know, I think we've heard that same sort of thing. We even had a show on, you know, just combating churn in general. But trying to keep your churn as low as possible maximizes your MRR for the long run. And I can totally see why they want a business with low churn. Not only does it signal product market fit, but it's going to help you grow your MRR even faster because you're just not going to have that leaking out every month.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. As far as we are, with Seriously Simple Podcasting, we are definitely, I think I alluded to it a little bit, sort of testing some marketing channels now and getting some data about what works and what doesn't work. And, I think going back to MicroConf 2 years ago, I had like the question to Stelly and Eaton, like, hey, okay, so you have a product, it has some level of product market fit. How do you pour gasoline on the fire and really make it go? And they were like, there's no answer to that, right? And this came out in literally three back-to-back talks where the folks from ChartMogul said, almost all of our new leads come through our blog. And we've been content marketing for, you know, since the first week of the business. The next was from an outbound email tool that they got all of their stuff through outbound email. And the third was the guys from Hotjar. Great, great sounding like product and really cool guys. They're like, yeah, we got all of our stuff through paid acquisition, through Facebook ads. And like, they're all really similarly size and scale B2B businesses. And I was like, okay, there is no like one way to do this. And I think it talks to like a couple of things with that. And like, one is all these people that we hear giving advice on like how to grow your business did one thing well, not that like a bunch of other shit couldn't work, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, it reminds me, I want to say that last year's talk at MicroConf from Patrick Campbell of Price Intelligently was focusing on one of those things. And I may have the guy wrong who actually did the talk. I'd have to look at my notes since I'm doing this off the top of my head. But I was pretty sure that he said, pick one channel and double down on that channel once you get it working. There's no need to go find another channel until you tap that channel out. Don't bother with anything else. And most people just don't go deep enough on doubling down and tripling down and trying to tap that to its maximum extent. Because when you find one thing that works, you got to just keep pushing whatever that is. If it's content marketing, build more content. If it's paid acquisition, buy more ads and get as many things in there as possible until you just aren't pulling out any more out of that channel than you possibly could. Because people just get too spread out. You know, they're trying a little bit of Facebook acquisition. They're trying a little bit of content. They're trying a little bit of social promotion. They're trying a little bit of outbound sales or whatever. And they don't, you know, they've got a lot of stuff and a lot of irons in the fire, but your resources are so spread out, you can't really tell if you pushed really hard on one of those things, which one's going to be the one. Because you might be getting a little bit of traction in each, but that could also be all the traction you'd ever get in there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or you might not be getting any traction because you're not putting enough into it. So you've really got to go with one, try it out, and get a binary decision on it. It works, it doesn't work. And then move on to the next one. When you find one that works, double the fuck down until you get nothing else out of it. So, and apologies that that wasn't Patrick Campbell's talk, but that was definitely one of the talks from MicroConf this past year. I remember that.
Yeah, you know, I think I know Lars Lofgren definitely gave.
It might have been Lars. It might have been Lars. Now that I'm thinking about it.
Yeah, he talked about that. Just that, like, most of us just get like the tip of the iceberg with a channel, and then how do you drain that rock, get blood out of that rock. Absolutely, man. I mean, I can tell you right now, and this is like a little embarrassing because I'm supposed to be like a marketing guy, but we have five channels we're looking at tapping for podcasting. And like, that's just stupid, you know? I mean, I think I can eliminate a couple of them just based on, you know, our expected LTV and stuff. But something that really kind of came to mind as I hear these three talks is the for a business, and this is definitely different for everyone, like the best marketing channel probably depends on the market you're in, your LTV, and your audience kind of like persona, right? So like the average user of your tool is going to be different for everybody. So thinking about, and Dave, we talked about this like for social media, like where are your people hanging out?
Yep.
I think that like that's probably the first place, like, so you have these four or five really commonly utilized marketing channels. So I would probably ask myself, and I am asking myself, where do my people go to learn more about podcasting, get like trusted advice and things like that? And there's probably a couple of answers. There's not like five. And so, yeah, that's where we're going to double down. And so something I kind of got out of this is hearing these three talks back to back. Yeah, it all made really good sense for each of these companies to do what they did, but it also had really strong alignment with the market and the audience and where they are kind of in their customer journey. The customer is in their buying journey. So I think that's something like a takeaway for people to think about. It's like, think about that, put yourself in your potential or ideal customer shoes, and then insert yourself at that point. And yeah, I think if you can have one really strong marketing channel, it's you're going to be successful. It's just so much less to think about. And you can optimize one thing really well, like the talk you're referring to.
Yep. It's important to stay focused on that. And that's the hardest thing with me in Recapture, not knowing what that channel is quite yet. Trying to push a bunch of content out there, it's still too early for me to say, does this work or not work? My intuition says it probably will work. I see a lot of competitors doing content that are out there. I mean, Shopify is like one of the biggest pushers of content in the market, and their machine is unbelievable. They have a ton of different content and a wide variety of e-commerce topics there. So obviously, and in fact, there was an article that came out recently about how they've moved themselves up to a $320 million a year business because of their content. So obviously it works for them, but you know, once somebody's in that space, can you focus on a particular niche and make it work for you. Because obviously my content and Shopify's content, we're going to have some overlap in there, but they're about trying to get people to sign up to be a store. I'm trying to say, here, you have a store, make more money with your store. So it's a slightly different message, you know, and there's different ways to spin the content as a result of that.
Yeah.
And, you know, you don't have to – it doesn't have to be me versus Shopify. Obviously, I am going to be on Shopify, so I don't necessarily consider myself a Shopify competitor. It doesn't even make sense. But against somebody like MailChimp, yeah, I'm definitely a competitor to MailChimp. And people want to sign up for things like that, and they use it for e-commerce. And there's a compelling story for me to say, hey, I'm better than MailChimp. I'm easier than MailChimp. I'm less expensive than MailChimp. So that stuff that I'm looking into right now, in addition to all of the content marketing that's going out there, but it's still going to take like 6 to 9 months. So we really only started that like last month.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, maybe generously, I guess we could say, well, no, because it really got – I had to start from the day it got published, not the day that it started to write. So we're looking at maybe like, you know, 3 to 4 weeks out in the wild at this point. You know, it doesn't change your organic traffic overnight with Business Directory. You know, I was looking at 6 to 9 months before I started seeing any hit on that. So here we're looking at sometime next spring, you know, maybe early next summer before I see a bump on that. So I got to invest in that for a while. So does that make sense for me to focus on another channel in the meantime? Yeah, probably, because I can't spend, you know, how much time do I personally spend on that? I don't spend a lot. You know, I look at the articles, somebody sends me an outline, I look at the topic, I approve the keyword, and then that's it. I'm done. I move on to something else. So there's obviously some bandwidth for me to look at other things like paid acquisition and trying to find the right audience to target there. So there's other experiments that have to be run in the meantime. So maybe there's a, maybe there's some room to do a couple at a time if you're doing stuff like that, long-term versus short-term channels. But yeah, five is probably right out, to quote Monty Python.
Right. Right. No, for sure. For sure. So, you know, an interesting thing I think would be a fun topic is how you are, sort of promoting your content and trying to build traffic around it. Cause we'll be getting into a similar boat soon with publishing more podcasting content for Serious Assemble Podcasting. And I think nowadays just publishing the odd blog post is not cutting it anymore. So like what things are we going to be doing to really market our content and build links and get social proof and things like that around our content that we're putting out there? Because that's probably the key to success with content like here in the end of 2017.
Well, it sounds like I have some work to do then, because right now my promotion of this content is not as intense as it probably should be. I mean, I have a bunch of articles that I've read that say, all right, here's what you do to build the content. Here's how do you figure out where to research the content, and here's what you're supposed to do to promote the content. And a lot of that is like trying to get guest posts or comments on other people's blogs or getting them to link back to your stuff and things like that. And I have really sucked at doing that, to be honest. So
yeah,
I'm trying some other things right now. We'll see how they come out. I don't think that they're a silver bullet, but it will be interesting to actually have something to talk about there. Yeah, we should definitely do that as a future podcast episode.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think anyone who's been to MicroConf heard Nathan Barry's talk when I was there two years ago for MicroConf. And he really took up – building ConvertKit or growing it, he's taken a direct selling and almost competitive selling approach to going after certain customers of like alternative tools. And so he and I had a – what for him was water-filled conversation. For me, it was cider and Ireland's finest conversation about this. But it was really interesting. And kind of the gist is like, if you're building a tool, it should be in a market where there's already competitors. Otherwise, you're creating a new market, which is really dangerous for anyone who's bootstrapping. So assuming that's the case, that you have customers that are already with like a competitive product, how can you kind of put yourself in a position to talk to customers who are already on a different platform? So like Dave, for you with Recapture, they're already using MailChimp, right?
Yep.
How can you have like marketing content and outreach and social media and like a funnel around converting users of competitive products to your tool. And the Startup Chat guys, Stelly and Heaton, did an episode about this recently. So we'll link to that in the show notes. It was a really great episode. But there's definitely like a right way and a wrong way to do this. So I think the wrong way can piss a lot of people off. The right way sounds like can be really successful. But I think for me, the thing I got out of the conversation with Nathan is like to think about this just like any other funnel, right? So like a customer can enter your funnel hopefully at the right time in their buying journey and their kind of customer experience with their business or their podcast or whatever, their store. And so like how can you kind of set yourself up to allow people into your funnel at the right time for them and then have the language around kind of their pains and experiences and the solutions you can offer. So this is something that we're definitely working on. We have two competitors that we've identified. We can say, okay, we definitely are better than them because of X, Y, and Z, and they're different for each of our competitors, which I think is, I don't know yet if that's good or bad, but we definitely have different messaging for the two competitors that we're going to be going after. But yeah, I guess it's just something to think about that like you want new customers who are just getting into the space, but there's a ton of existing customers in, I think, both of our spaces. So like, why not set up like a funnel and email and ads and outreach to start having the conversation with those users of existing competitive tools to say like, hey, what's going on with using MailChimp? How do you like it? Can I show you what we have? I'd love to get your feedback on it and then go from there and who knows. But I think this is an interesting channel and one kind of like Facebook ads and not like content where you can push the pedal on this and start sending a bunch of outreach emails and running a bunch of Facebook ads to like the, you know, recapture versus MailChimp landing page that you put together, right? So like, That's just something that, I don't know. We're definitely thinking about this. This is probably going to be one of our bigger areas of focus long-term.
Yeah, I saw this a lot when I was trying to do support Vine. A lot of help desk software services will do this. So Groove did it on Zendesk versus Groove's email versus Groove. And Helpscout did the exact same thing. So I don't know who copied who. But even Zendesk started doing it with them and some larger, uglier competitors. It exists and it's, you know, there are definitely examples of it being well done. When I tried to set up Support Vine, I actually, well, you know, when I did it at first, I'll say that my attempt was a little clumsy and I used language that probably angered some people because I tested it out and I drove some paid traffic to the page. And a few people said some stuff about it. Like they were, you know, they put a comment not on the site, but they actually contacted me and said, you know, this messaging is a little off. I feel kind of put off by what you're saying here. I was like, oh, okay. And I thought I was trying to make Support Vine look really good, but I did it in a way that was really overly trashing Zendesk and Desk.com.
Yeah.
And it really fell flat. So, yeah, you got to be really careful about this. But I've noticed that Help Scout and Groove do a really good job about it where they, you know, they mention – I guess you could say in passing, you know, they don't highlight the fact that Zendesk is really clunky or the interface is complicated or, you know, and these are all problems with Zendesk. If you go look at and Google Zendesk reviews or Zendesk problems or Zendesk sucks, I mean, you'll get a lot of people that have some strong opinions about Zendesk. So obviously you could take that and throw it onto a page and say, hey, this is what the competition is saying about these guys. We're not like that at all and call it a competition page. That's what I tried to do with Support Vine. That doesn't work well. The way that Help Scout and Groove do it instead is to sort of mention here are the really positive aspects, you know, and then they're more like, are you struggling with Zendesk? You know, like let the customer answer that in their head, because if they're not, then they can just immediately move off the page and you've got nothing really negative on there and a bunch of positive stuff. So if they read, great, but if they don't, you've lost nothing. Mm-hmm. And they weren't really in the right mindset to convert anyway. But if they answer that question in the affirmative, then they can start going through and figure it out. Because there's always that, the inertia of trying to switch. And, you know, you got to hit somebody at the right time in order to make them want to switch platforms. Like, they have to be pissed off with that provider to think, I'm done with these guys.
Yeah.
And that's when your message can be really effective. So what I was trying to do in SupportVine was to put that message out early enough, so when I started getting to a point where I could go to beta, I could take some of those people and pull them in and get it working. But I never got to a point where I could refine that message. I just got the first round of that as, oh, this is a little heavy-handed, Dave, or, you know, I don't really like what you're saying here. I don't think I'm going to try your product now. Mm-hmm. Like, that kind of feedback. And I was like, oh, okay, won't do that again.
Yeah.
So, important lesson, don't be overly negative in your message. Customers tend not to like that. So, but this is definitely something on my radar as well. MailChimp is a clear competitor. Another one I keep hearing a lot about in my space is also one called Klaviyo, which is more e-commerce oriented. MailChimp is obviously more generic, but they have specific automations and workflows for e-commerce now. But the feedback that I'm hearing from people that use these things are that it's a little clunky. It's not as easy as I'd like it to be. I have to jump through a lot of hoops to make it work. The integration is okay, but, you know, it's not as native and, you know, tight as I want it to be. So there is definitely an opportunity for me to market there. I was looking at some keyword volumes for these things just before we got on the podcast here, and it's not zero. It's not like, you know, 10,000 a month either, unfortunately, but it's definitely a channel worth exploring for me.
Yeah. We put out one, us versus SoundCloud recently. And that's a place where, like, just our features for podcasting, right? SoundCloud is not a podcasting platform, so just our features are really appealing. I should be for a podcaster, it's already been positive for us. I think you're absolutely right that the way that we approached it, we took a page out of the Drift book. So Drift has done a really good job of this, I think, versus Intercom. Intercom also has done a really good job versus things like OLARC. But I think that you got to just say, like, are you using X product? Here's what we do in this space. And I think if you can just say positive, 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 positive for my tool, and then just say, hey, you want to give it a try, here it is, or here's a video that explains, or invite them to a webinar, or whatever it is, it's a landing page, right? It's not like the place where you're going to get married. But it's a first discussion. That's how we look at it, at least, is like, it's a place we'll drive Facebook traffic to, and then capture people's email or retarget them or whatever. I think, it's a piece of content, and like you're saying, it could have really strong SEO value, but it also can be a cool place just to drive people to. I think, yeah, you definitely can do this right. And you can definitely do it wrong. I think something that Heaton talked about in their podcast episode was, everyone is doing it. So if you're not doing it, whether you think it's right or wrong, you're getting screwed, right? So if everyone's doing it and you're not, you look weak and not involved. So however you want to do it, you probably should be doing some version of this, so that your audience and your competitors and your prospects kind of see that you're involved and aware of your competition and highlighting how you're better or different. That's something I took away in this, like, a lot of data points kind of coming together. But I think this is a really interesting place to look at top of funnel stuff and awareness.
And I think another thing, when you position yourself against another competitor, you're kind of basically saying, look, I'm on par with these guys. You know, you're kind of putting yourself in that same ring. You know, somebody could look at you and say, oh, well, Recapture is like a tiny little business compared to MailChimp. But if you're basically going in and saying, I can do this for e-commerce, you know, you're punching way above your weight, but you're putting yourself out there saying, I've got what you need that you think these other guys already have.
Mm-hmm.
So you create that comparison in your mind, even if that comparison didn't exist for your customer. And I think that's valuable right there. That's probably why everybody is doing it, because they want to go and compare themselves to other successful ones. Hey, look, we're just like Zendesk, you know? Great, because now, you know, Zendesk is a hugely successful customer software SaaS app. And if you compare yourself to Zendesk, you're saying, hey, we can do everything that Zendesk can do and better,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So
yep.
I think that's a valuable comparison if you can put yourself in that positive frame of reference.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And the last thing, it's a quick point here, but talking about churn, and several people made this discussion. I don't think we talked about it a ton on our churn episode, but expansion MRR as like a dragon glass, right, for all you Game of Thrones fans, like against churn is kind of a lot of people's secret, right? So expansion MRR is, okay, so you're a drip customer, right? You have, I don't know what their tiers are now, but you have 1,500 people when you start using them. You get up to 3,000, you go from $49 a month to $99 a month. That's expansion MRR for drip. So you're worth $50 per month more to drip than you were last month. And so this combats directly people who churn. And so I saw several graphs of people saying, if you don't have expansion MRR, churn is going to kill you, because in a lot of cases, expansion MRR overcomes your churn. So you have like net negative churn, or at least minimizes it to where your total kind of lost revenue in a month is very, very small. So at this point, Seriously Simple Podcasting has just one plan. And so now we're trying to think about like, okay, how can we allow our customers to be more successful? And for us, that means making more money. And so we're thinking about a couple of different ways to do this. And one is obviously like pricing tiers. So like if they publish more episodes, or if they have more downloads, or if they want to get involved in like more parts of our product that we're building, then that allows more paying customers and existing customers to pay more. I think however you can craft that, Dave, for you, it's probably dollars on your store, right? So like building that into your app and letting your customers be more successful and existing customers make more money for you is kind of like the hidden secret, it sounded like, especially against churn.
Yeah, you know, I've looked at a lot of competitors for recapture, and pricing is sort of it's a difficult thing to do in my space. I've seen a lot of different ways to do it. So some of them go for a flat percentage to say, we'll just take 3% of your recovered revenue that we're helping build for you and let you send however much email you want and let you have whatever features you want. It's just a flat price. That's it. So the more successful you are, the more money we make. So in that sense, it's not really expansion MRR. You're just, you know, it's charging one price, and the better that they do with you, the longer they're going to stay and the more value they get out of your app. So that's kind of like expansion MRR. But then there's other ones where they charge based on the number of customers that you have that are contacted through the app, where they'll charge up to a certain number of contacts. And then if you want to get more contacts, you have to go up. So that's increasing your value in there. And then some of them do it on a tiered value where they'll say, all right, if you get up to $1,000 a month in revenue, we'll charge you $29. And if you recover more than $5,000 a month in revenue, we'll charge you $99 or something. And, you know, that's, you know, one of those little magic controls that says, how much do you want to recover a month? And this, we'll tell you how much it's going to cost. So I think that gets a little more complicated because customers don't know upfront how much are you going to really recover for me. And maybe they would be like, oh, wow, you got, you know, $10,000 in the month. I'm happy to pay you $299 a month. So there's definitely value to be had out of that. And then there's some of my competitors that do it based on the number of emails sent. And that's what we're using as our metric right now, is the number of emails you send. So the more emails you send, the more money you get back. But it's a flat pricing plan based on that.
You have tiers based on it?
Yeah, there's basically three tiers of emails, less than 2,000, 2,000 to 10,000, and then more than 10,000.
Mm-hmm.
I've never really loved that tiering, and I feel like it's a little too broad in the middle there. So it feels like it could go a little more granular in the middle, but I haven't really spent the time to figure out what makes the most sense yet, because getting onto Shopify felt like it was more important than twiddling the pricing right now.
Yeah.
Since I really just need more customers, and then I can tweak the pricing to find out what's the right one for all my customers. So it's definitely an open question for me. But in terms of trying to expand your business, if you, people aren't finding value in your tool and they're not wanting to upgrade in any way with your tool, you're going to have a hard time getting a long, big LTV out of those folks. So that's the bottom line, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think the nature of podcasting is, and the precedence that's been set in this industry of hosting is stacked against us a little bit. And honestly, this is the one thing that I look at and say, how the fuck am I going to do that? Because there's not a major competitor that charges on downloads or bandwidth, which is the thing that costs us money and is the indication of like a successful show, right? John Lee Dumas has, whatever, 100,000 downloads an episode. That costs his hosting provider a lot of money, and it means he's a more successful podcast. So in this sense, that should be kind of how we price things. Turns out in the podcast hosting world, about half of the people just have a flat pricing like we do now, or based on storage. Anyone who's gone into like AWS and S3 knows that storage costs literally nothing, like almost nothing. We migrated a guy the other day with like 8 gigs of podcast episodes from a couple of years ago. And I know that that guy will cost us like 5 cents a month, you know, because like it just doesn't cost anything to store it. It costs money to move it out the door. And so, yeah, for us, this is something that we're honestly kind of scratching. I'm scratching my head about a little bit. It's like, how can I allow my customers to be more successful and get involved with our products more? So this is probably the biggest question I left SaaStalk with, is how can we create opportunities for expansion MRR in our business? Because I don't see anyone else doing it, you know, aside from you and I deciding like, hey, we're going to publish a podcast episode every day. Then maybe if you're on like a storage based tier thing, then you would move up to the next storage tier. But the fact that we have a hard enough time getting a show out every week, I don't think that's happening.
I was going to say, that's never going to happen, dude.
Yeah. Yeah. So
yeah. I think the quality would be going down. So what'd you have for breakfast today?
Right. Right.
Well, you can contemplate that at your next board meeting with you and a glass of Bordeaux. That's your royal we, right?
That's exactly right. Yep. Yep. So, but yeah, man. So overall, a really great conference. I think for people who have the opportunity to go something like Business Software or SASTR in San Francisco, or come to Ireland and go to SaaStalk, I think it's a really interesting contrast to something like MicroConf. And I will probably be going back next year. I think it's a really kind of healthy balance to strike, to say like, how do these hypergrowth businesses approach the things that they're struggling with, and what things as a bootstrap solo kind of founder can I take and implement in my business? So yeah, it was a really solid thing. I think we've talked about this before, going into it with eyes wide open and knowing the context that people are coming from made me kind of accept some of the things that I heard at face value and not really take them to heart, which was pretty healthy.
Well, it sounds like you had a good time.
Yeah.
And thanks for the report here. It was very informative and educational. So if you have any questions for Craig about SaaStalk or what we talked about on the episode today in general, please send us an email, podcast@roguestartups.com. And if you've got a minute, And if you have a minute, please drop us a review in iTunes. We'd love to hear what you think of the show. Thanks, and we'll see you next week.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Rogue Startups. If you haven't already, head over to iTunes and leave a rating and review for the show. For show notes from each episode and a few extra resources to help you along your journey, head over to roguestartups.com to learn more.